Good afternoon. Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Today's speaker is Peter Kornbluh, Senior Analyst at the National Security Archive in Washington and Director of the Archive's Cuba and Chile Documentation Projects. He is co-author of the forthcoming book, Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Mr. Kornbluh spoke recently in Portland addressing the World Affairs Council of Maine on the Cuba policy breakthrough, the back-channel diplomacy that led to normalized relations with Cuba. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. There you can find this and many other past Speaking in Maine programs. It's also available as a podcast. Check our website, or you can find us on iTunes.
Thank you so much. It's such a real pleasure to be here. The World Affairs Council, not only in Maine but across the country, is an extraordinary organization, an extraordinary grouping nationally and community-wise of interested and active people. So I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank Tim for getting me up here, because it's a real pleasure to come to Maine, to be in this beautiful city, even, you know, in the middle of this harsh winter. I also want to say that it's a tremendous honor to be at Pierce Atwood. Not only is it a stunningly beautiful facility that obviously invites the most creative and inspirational kind of presentation possible, but it is the firm where John O'Leary worked, and he and his wife were known to the legal community here and the whole political and social community of Portland. And so it's important that I actually start with them. How many of you actually knew John and Patricia? A few of you, so not very many, and I know we've talked about them a lot. John, who's over there to your left, to the far left, was mayor of Portland for, I think, 2 years, and it was in the early 1980s, wasn't it? His wife, Patricia Cepeda, is here in the dark brown hair next to Bill Clinton on the other side of Hillary Clinton. You can just imagining, you know, seeing how young everybody was then. I don't know if you recognize the other famous people in this picture. There are several very famous people. The one right here to your far right is Carlos Fuentes, the very famous Mexican writer. Standing next to him is William Styron, whose house this picture, whose house on Martha's Vineyard this picture was taken at. Then, of course, Patricia, you know, the president and his wife. Next to Hillary Clinton is Rose Styron. And then there next to John O'Leary is Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Yes, that is Gabo with the white mustache. Now, what are they doing there? Well, you'd think they're just having dinner, because the president is vacationing down the road in August of 1994. The Styrons want to host a nice gathering for him. They invite a bunch of people to come from all over the world, actually, and some of their neighbors. Not in this picture, but at the party, were people like Vernon Jordan, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America, William Lures, and his wife Wendy, and a whole host of others. This was the kind of core group. So that was publicly what was going on, but privately, what is going on in this picture is that Gabriel Garcia Marquez has arrived with a secret message from Fidel Castro to give to the President of the United States under the cover of what I call kind of cocktail diplomacy. He is with his always interpreter, John O'Leary's wife, Patricia Cepeda, who grew up in Colombia and whose father was a close friend and colleague of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez happens to be a very close friend. He was a close friend of Fidel Castro's and a confidant for many, many, many years. And he became a rather close friend and confidant of Bill Clinton's as well. And so when the United States and Cuba were in the middle of this crisis in 1994 over migration, it was called the Rafters Crisis, or in Spanish, the Balsero Crisis, there was the issue of how to end it and what the Cubans wanted and what the United States wanted. And Garcia Marquez was carrying a message from Fidel Castro proposing ideas about how to end the crisis and what Castro wanted to see in return. They talked. I have this vision of them talking quietly in the corner of the kitchen, and with Patricia standing there translating between the two. They also talked about Cuba at the dinner table. She sat between the president and Garcia Marquez. They talked about Cuba. Bill Clinton had a rather tough response because you may not know this, but the only time he lost a political race was his second race for governor in Arkansas, and he lost because of a prison riot of Cubans who'd come over on the Mariel boatlift in 1980, and had the federal government, Carter, had sent them a bunch of them out to the ones that had committed crimes and weren't going to be allowed to stay. He'd sent them to a prison in Arkansas, and they rioted, and this created a big kind of public relations scandal for Clinton in the middle of his run for re-election for governor, and he lost. And he always held this against Carter for sending these prisoners to Arkansas, and Castro for letting these undesirables come to the United States to begin with. And so his response was, please, you know, I'll work with you, but please go back and tell Fidel, no more Mariels, you know. This crisis is not going to, is going to be met with a much harsher response in the end. But this was the beginning of 2 weeks of very secret back and forth diplomacy, which did, in the end, and terminate, finish this extraordinary migration crisis, and moved U.S.-Cuban relations actually onto a new footing for the next couple of years, in which a lot of talks went on, a lot of progress was made. And, you know, that progress is an echo of the type of progress that we have seen in the last 5 or 6 weeks, at the end of last year and at the first couple of months of this year. This is a photograph taken on December 16th, 2014, last year, of the President of the United States on the phone, for the first time on the phone, with the President of Cuba since the revolution in 1959. And Obama is talking to Raul Castro. They speak for 45 minutes. They're talking about what's going to happen the very next day, December 17th, 2014, the day the world changed in U.S.-Cuban relations. It was such a dramatic day that the Cubans now refer to it as 17D. It sounds like an apartment number, but in fact, this is this historic day. And one of the people in this picture sitting in the room later told me there was a sense of history in the room as the two presidents on the phone discussed what was going to happen the next day. What was going to happen? A plane from the United States of America was going, in fact, an Air Force One plane, a presidential jet, was going to fly into a small airport outside of Havana, carrying an entourage of senators and congressmen and family members who were going to receive Alan Gross, the USAID contractor who had been imprisoned in Cuba for surreptitiously smuggling in satellite communications equipment into the country. And he'd been in prison for 5 years, and he was going to get on this plane, and he was going to be flown back to the United States. Another plane was also going to come from the United States. And in fact, the Alan Gross plane, Air Force One, was not going to be allowed to leave Cuba until that plane landed. And that plane had on it three Cuban agents, spies that Castro had sent to the United States in the mid-1990s to kind of monitor exile operations in Florida, counterterrorism agents, really. And they were going to be repatriated. They had been in prison for 16 years in the United States. They were going to be repatriated to their homeland, Cuba, and Alan Gross was going to be let go. And then one other person was going to be allowed to leave as well, a CIA informant inside the Cuban intelligence service who'd been caught and imprisoned in the 1990s by Cuban intelligence, a man by the name of Rolando Saraf, who'd been passing intelligence to the CIA for a number of years. And he was going to come home as part of this exchange. And then what was going to happen? Obama told Raul Castro that President Obama was going to announce that the kind of history of was going to be buried. The history of U.S. aggression towards Cuba was going to come to an end. The United States was going to cease its efforts at regime change in Cuba and adopt normal diplomatic relations and hopefully soon normal overall relations with Cuba. This was extraordinary. And the next day, on the 17th, both presidents, as you may recall, went on television at exactly the same time, 12 noon, in both countries, and told the respective audience in Cuba and in the United States that this agreement had happened, that the prisoner exchange had taken place, and that from now on, U.S.-Cuban relations and U.S. policy towards Cuba was going to be very, very different. Now, I was in Cuba at the time, and I had to prove that I was in Cuba. Actually, I had a picture of me taken standing next to the TV set when Raul Castro was speaking so that everybody would know that I had been there. And, you know, it was just an amazing experience for somebody who's spent at least 30 years now working on changing Cuba policy to be there when this actually happened. It was really extraordinary set of circumstances. And the first thing that happened, of course, was that everybody in the hotel, the maids, the receptionists, the bartenders, start clapping and laughing and cheering. They're cheering because these spies have come back. And the spies have been turned into heroes, abroad, and finally they've actually returned. But then as this news started to filter in, you did find people starting to think about how better relations with the United States was going to affect their daily lives. Not necessarily their political lives, but certainly their economic lives. And the next morning, I went out to take a taxi to go down and do some U.S. television shows from a building overlooking Havana Bay. And the taxi driver said to me, I'm with my other friends. They're all taxi drivers. We're all thinking about when we're going to be able to buy a Ford van, an upgrade from some of these old cars that we're driving from the 1950s to modern cars which hold more people and burn less gas. And I said, well, I don't know when that'll happen, but I hope it happens soon. And one of the things we will talk about, certainly in question and answer, is the fact that even though Obama has taken these steps, the embargo remains in place. That is going to take a vote in Congress to change. And that is the debate that is going on in Washington today. How, when, who is going to lift the legislation that keeps the kind of overall trade sanctions in place, and who is going to vote for lifting the complete ban on travel to Cuba, so you and I can go, and we can go on vacation if we want, and we can go visit and see friends, or just buy art, or smoke cigars, or take salsa lessons. That legislation is in play as well. Now, President Obama is the first president since 1959 to succeed in truly changing the policy. I like to say that he used the F word when he addressed the American public: failure. He told the American public, this policy has failed and we have to change it. And he is the first president since Fidel Castro took power in 1959, and since relations were broken by President Eisenhower in early 1961, to change a policy that Henry Kissinger referred to as perpetual aggression towards Cuba. But he's not the first president to have tried, and that's the most interesting thing. A number of presidents have tried previous to Obama. They've gotten down the road a bit on certain elements of this. They failed for one reason or another, but they've set examples that Obama followed. What's even more interesting is that when you look at the history that we spent 10 years compiling for this book, Back Channel to Cuba, you see that Fidel Castro, even though the kind of conventional narrative is that he is the most aggressive and anti-American in his rhetoric and his posture, Fidel Castro has reached out to every president since John Kennedy to see if better relations would be possible. And I'm going to walk you through just a few of the examples of Castro reaching out. This is a declassified memorandum of conversation between Che Guevara, who was Fidel's right-hand man after the revolution, and Richard Goodwin, who was John F. Kennedy's right-hand man on Latin America after Kennedy was elected. And they had a secret meeting in Montevideo, Uruguay, in August of 1961. It was just 5 months after the CIA-led Bay of Pigs attack. Basically, U.S. intervention, military, paramilitary intervention in Cuba. 5 months later, Fidel Castro felt that it would be important to reach out and ask the Kennedy administration whether, as Che Guevara put it, a modus vivendi would be possible. And they had a long conversation. It lasted all night long. Che Guevara practiced the art of cigar diplomacy. He gave Goodwin a box of beautiful cigars to bring back to President Kennedy, who was famous for being an avid cigar smoker. As the story goes, Goodwin came back to the White House. He keyed out this memo of conversation. He brought the box and the memo into the president's office, the Oval Office. Kennedy, not interested in the memo, wants to open the box of cigars, starts smoking one, pulls out a cigar, clips it, lights it up, takes a puff, and then pauses and tries to hand it to Goodwin and saying, "Maybe you should take the first puff." To which Goodwin appropriately responds, "It's too late now, Mr. President." Both of them obliquely referring to the potential to use a cigar as an assassination device, something that, by the way, the CIA avidly tried to do in its efforts to kill Fidel Castro over the years. So that was the first effort to reach out through this secret meeting. Kennedy was killed, of course, in Dallas. He was in the middle of actual secret talks with Fidel Castro at that moment, really at the moment that he was killed, and I'll talk about that in a second. But following his death, Fidel Castro sent a secret message with a ABC News reporter named Lisa Howard, who was down in Cuba interviewing him, for Lyndon Johnson in February of 1964, saying, "President Johnson, did you know we were in talks with President Kennedy? Do you want to continue those talks? We are willing to continue those talks. We know that 1964 is a difficult political year. If you want to attack us verbally or even physically to prove your, you know, moderate and right-wing bona fides in respect to Richard Nixon or Barry Goldwater, whoever you're going to be running against for the presidency, we will understand if you tell us that this is all politics. But we would like to talk further. Please do not misinterpret my effort to reach out to you as a sign of weakness. It is not." And that is the message that he sent really literally in the first 8 weeks of the first 3 months of the Johnson administration to see if better relations might be possible. He also reached out to Richard Nixon, and this was the most extraordinary document that I came across out of hundreds and hundreds that we found for the book and got declassified. Richard Nixon, there's a picture of him shaking Fidel's hand on the front of the book. They met in April of 1959 when Fidel Castro came to Washington on his first post-revolution trip. They had a very acrimonious meeting with Nixon basically telling Fidel all the things he had to do, including, you know, fight the communists in his government and listen to the United States. And Fidel felt that Nixon was condescending and paternalistic and that it hadn't been a very productive meeting. But Nixon, for all his right-wing credentials, received an extraordinary message only 10 days after his inauguration. And it basically was Fidel Castro using intermediaries saying there are a number of things we would like to talk about, there are a number of issues we have to discuss, and maybe this could lead to broader talks. Even Ronald Reagan, the most anti-communist, cold warrior of them all, got messages and gestures from the Cubans about talking about what was going on in Central America, about better relations. This is a memo that Reagan received kind of referring to all these gestures and communications the Cubans were making and recommending that the United States government just completely diss them and dismiss them as propaganda, which, of course, Ronald Reagan was happy to do. But, you know, even Reagan, with his anti-communist posture, his aggressive stance towards Cuba and Nicaragua and Central America and, frankly, the rest of the world, was forced to negotiate with the Cubans and did negotiate with the Cubans. And this is another very interesting part of this precedent-setting history that Obama drew on, the fact that all of his predecessors, going back to Eisenhower, had actually engaged in serious talks of one kind or another with the Cubans. Now, some of these talks were about what the political scientists called secondary issues, not the bigger picture, not all of our framework of our relations, but key issues like migration, like counter-narcotics collaboration, like counter-terrorism cooperation and collaboration. But other presidents, Kennedy, Gerald Ford, led by Henry Kissinger, his Secretary of State, and Jimmy Carter, specifically engaged in talks with the Cubans about actually having perfectly normal relations and a coexistence between our two countries. And this effort goes all the way back to John Kennedy in the spring of 1963, when Kennedy, emerging kind of somewhat smarter and more learned after the Cuban Missile Crisis about the dangers of the Cold War, decided to entertain seriously a proposal by one of his top aides, Gordon Chase, on the National Security Council, that the Kennedy administration forego what Chase refers to in this memo as the covert nastiness of our policy and adopt the sweet approach, quote, the sweet approach to Cuba, trying to, quote, entice Castro over to us. In other words, the carrots rather than the sticks. And this was the first memo of its kind laying out the theory of why this would be a useful proposition to explore, and Kennedy actually seriously explored it. But like Obama, who used all sorts of secret intermediaries to pass messages back and forth to the Cubans before the famous phone call for almost 18 months, Kennedy, for almost the better part of a year, used three separate intermediaries, a lawyer and two journalists. The lawyer was James Donovan. He was a famous Cold War negotiator. He negotiated prisoner releases with the Soviet Union. He negotiated with Castro the release of over 1,000 Bay of Pigs prisoners that he got home to their families. He got their families out of Cuba as well and brought them to the United States Christmas time of 1962. Fidel and him started talking about yet another prisoner exchange. There were three CIA agents who'd been caught red-handed putting listening devices in the ceiling of a building in Havana that were in Castro's jails, and there were another two dozen American citizens who'd been swept up after the revolution for one charge or another of counter-revolutionary or subversive activity, and the Kennedy administration wanted them back, and Castro wanted four Cubans who were in prison in the United States for a variety of charges, and that exchange was finalized and negotiated and finalized in the spring of 1963. And as it was being finalized, Castro said to James Donovan, you know, we've come this far. We're actually talking to each other. What would it take for us to really change relations between the United States and Cuba? And Donovan responded, Mr. Premier, do you know how porcupines make love? And Castro said, I can't say that I do. And Donovan's response was, very carefully. And that is how you and the United States will come together and talk about change in relations. And that kind of cautionary approach has dominated up until just the end of last year, the ensuing 50-plus years of time. Kennedy used Donovan for these messages, and he brought back, of course, that message of the porcupine discussion. Donovan turned the baton of secret talks over to a rather extraordinary journalist from ABC News named Lisa Howard. Do any of you remember Lisa Howard? She died almost 50 years ago, but in the early 60s, she was the Barbara Walters of her day. She was the first woman to have her own news show called News with a Woman's Touch, sponsored by Purex on ABC. She was ABC's choice to go to the Vienna summit between Khrushchev and Kennedy and interview both of them. And once she started interviewing Fidel Castro for ABC News special in 1963, she became committed secretly to improving relations and started carrying messages back and forth to the White House and to Cuba and set up a kind of a communications central in her condo just off of Central Park on 74th Street in New York City, where U.S. officials would come. She would place a call to Castro's office, and they would talk. And it was through this effort that an actual meeting to discuss improving relations was being set up. The last journalist, a French journalist named Jean Daniel, was literally conveying a message to Fidel Castro from Kennedy about the potential for better relations on November 22nd, 1963, when an aide to Castro came in and said, "The president has been shot in Dallas." And Castro turned to Jean Daniel and said, "There goes your mission of peace." And he was certainly correct. Now, fast forward 10 years, and you have Henry Kissinger, who of all people, he'd be the last person I would have thought would have decided to try and normalize relations with Castro's Cuba, but he did. Kissinger faced a situation not unsimilar to what Obama has faced, and that is a complete rebellion of the Latin American community over U.S. policy towards Cuba. And in the early 1970s, the Latin American countries were adamant that they did not want to continue multilateral sanctions against the Castro regime, that they wanted to restore their diplomatic relations, that they wanted to restore their trade relations, and that they were going to do this with the United States or without the United States. And Kissinger decided that since he was going to lose this vote at the OAS anyway, he might as well turn it into a kind of diplomatic negotiation chip with the Cubans. He would tell the Cubans that he would support this vote in the OAS if X, Y, and Z happened and they could arrive at an agreement. And he actually sent a handwritten message to Fidel, also, like Kennedy, using a journalist, in this case Frank Mankiewicz, the famous Democratic Party operative who had been Robert Kennedy's press secretary, and eventually became president of National Public Radio. And Kissinger's thought was, A, Mankiewicz has access to Fidel because he's going to interview him for a CBS special, and B, if word leaked that this message had gone to Castro, because it's Frank Mankiewicz, Kissinger could just say it was some liberal Democrat who was doing this on his own, and there would be this concept of plausible denial. And so he sent this initial message in July of 1974, just in the final days of the Nixon administration. He never told Nixon that he was doing this. And this message led to secret talks between the United States and Cuba. The very first meeting was accompanied by this aide memoir. "We are meeting here to explore the possibilities for a more normal relationship between our two countries." The tone of this was very even-handed. "Our ideological differences are vast, but that does not mean that we can't actually live together." And this memo was given to the Cubans, a Cuban team that had flown in from Havana, in a, you know, the most secret of places, the grungy cafeteria at LaGuardia Airport, where they actually had the first secret meeting between Kissinger's representatives and the and the Cubans. There was a series of other meetings culminating in a swanky meeting at the Pierre Hotel off of Central Park in New York, which was the first true negotiating session in which both sides brought their platforms, brought their agendas, and sat for 3 hours discussing them. And after 3 hours, Larry Eagleburger, who was the lead negotiator for Kissinger, started to look at his watch and needed to leave. And the Cubans, of course, were just getting started after 3 hours. You know, Fidel was famous for his 8, 10, 14-hour meetings and discourses, and they just wanted to stay all night, but the Americans had to leave. There was a series of other secret meetings in Washington and in New York. I think that that was the moment that relations actually could have been normalized, but Castro had a kind of other priorities, and he had received a request from a leader of Angola, Agustin Nieto, to send troops to help Nieto fend off CIA-led guerrillas and South African-backed militants that were trying to roll back the MPLA government in Angola, as Angola was going from being a colonial state of Portugal to being an independent country. And Castro wanted to be head of the non-aligned movement, and head of kind of the third world left. And so he sent those troops, 36,000 of them. And Kissinger was apoplectic. We tell the story in the book, and this was the lead story in the New York Times when the book came out last fall. Kissinger went into the Oval Office and told Gerald Ford, "I think we might have to smash the Cubans. We might have to clobber the Cubans, but we'll have to wait until after the 1976 elections." Of course, luckily Gerald Ford didn't get reelected in 1976. Kissinger actually ordered secret contingency plans for attacking Cuba to be drawn up, and they were drawn up, and we obtained them and published them in the book for the very first time, which was what the New York Times story was all about. So this initiative went from being very positive to being hostile and negative. It reverted back to the old United States posture towards Cuba very, very quickly. But Jimmy Carter, when he was elected, actually kind of picked up the ball where Kissinger had left it off. Jimmy Carter, I think, in many ways, is the true predecessor of Barack Obama. He philosophically believed, like Obama, that we should negotiate with our enemies, that the use of force was not likely to advance our interests with states like Cuba and elsewhere. And he actually ordered, in the first 7 weeks of his presidency, in this secret directive, the only one of its kind until Obama came along, that the U.S. government move secretly on a step-by-step process to normalize relations with Cuba. And in the first 6 or 7 months of 1976, it was just like that. There were meetings, negotiations, they were all very positive. We went from having no diplomatic relations to establishing these kind of embassy-like entities called interest sections. Cuba has an interest section in Washington. The United States has an interest section, which is in its old embassy building in Havana. And these are the interest sections that now Obama is saying should be officially transformed into full embassies. So it all started here. But over the course of 3 years, there were 6 or 7 secret meetings. They took place in Mexico. They took place in Atlanta and New York City. And eventually a team of Carter representatives actually went to Havana and met face-to-face with Fidel Castro. And the issue was always the same. The United States wanted better relations with the Cubans. We were willing to lift the embargo, but we had one precondition. The precondition was that Cuba get its troops out of Africa. And Fidel Castro's response, which is recorded in the book from a declassified transcript of the memorandum of conversation, was very clear. He basically said to the negotiators, "You know, I don't come to Washington and tell you how to conduct your foreign policy. And I've never understood why the United States feels that it has the right to come to Cuba or any other country and tell another country how to conduct their foreign policy. There is no universal prerogative that you have that I don't have as the leader of Cuba in how we conduct our government and how you conduct yours. And frankly, we see these as distinct issues. You never should have imposed the embargo on us to begin with, and you shouldn't demand that we change our foreign policy to accommodate your needs, your political needs, to lift the embargo. You should just lift the embargo. And that was the sticking point. And all the meetings, and particularly the last one with Castro, kept coming back to that. Jimmy Carter clearly intended, and we have the declassified documents to prove this, that when he had a second term, he would still move forward on normalizing relations with Cuba. But of course, he didn't get a second term. One of the reasons he didn't get a second term was the hostage crisis in Iran. Another reason was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And a third reason was the Mariel boat lift, which we mentioned earlier, that cost Bill Clinton his governorship in Arkansas and made Carter look rather weak with the Cubans. There was a lot of secret talks there. To end the Mariel boat lift, Carter promised Castro that in a second term, there would be a full discussion of normalizing relations and lifting the embargo. And of course, there was no second term. When you do a kind of political science-y type of comparison between what Obama faced and what Carter faced, you find a lot of similarities. Carter used secret diplomacy to talk to the Cubans. He was very tightly held. Only his top aides knew about these talks. There was a prisoner exchange that he conducted with Castro. There were, again, CIA agents that had been caught in Cuba. The CIA wanted them back. Carter eventually traded Puerto Rican nationalists who had been arrested in the mid-1950s for shooting up the U.S. Capitol. And they were let go in return for the release of these CIA agents. And Carter shared Obama's position that it's just better policy to have better relations with Cuba and advance U.S. interests. Obama actually had the same philosophy. You may remember that when he ran for president and during the primaries with Hillary Clinton, there was this big debate over his commitment to sit down and talk to the Iranians and sit down and talk to the Cubans. And Clinton's position was, oh, I would never do that. And Obama said, I would do that. And of course, as you know from the uproar in Washington this week over the Netanyahu visit, the issue has been these talks with the Iranians. And Obama actually engaged in secret talks with the Cubans for the last 2 years leading up to this breakthrough. But before that, two additional years of talks that nobody knows about but will be detailed in the next version, the next edition of Back Channel to Cuba when it comes out towards the end of the year. The main roadblock was getting Alan Gross out. And then there was this mystery man who I referred to earlier, Rolando Saraf Trujillo, the spy the CIA had cultivated inside Cuban intelligence. And then the issue was biting the political bullet and releasing these remaining three Cuban spies who had been in U.S. prisons for 16 years. And Obama, it took a long time. It took the intervention of the Pope. It took secret activities by Alan Gross's lawyer, Scott Gilbert, who played an extraordinary legal role in pressuring the administration with legal memo after legal memo, a whole analysis of the conviction and the kind of bad prosecution of these three spies in Miami in the mid-1990s. And finally, the president was convinced to make this prisoner swap, and that immediately opened the door to his ability to change the policy. He must have read, perhaps, the very ending of the book, Back Channel to Cuba, which recommended that he, quote, just do it, that he not adopt, as his predecessors had, a kind of any preconditions, that he not ask the Cubans for quid pro quo, step by step, that he not do what Clinton wanted to do, which was something called calibrated response. We would do one thing, then the Cubans would do another, and then we would escalate to this, and then they would escalate to that, and eventually we arrive to better normal relations. No. He basically said, I am just going to do it unilaterally all at once. I'm not even going to ask the Cubans essentially for anything really in return. He did ask them to release 53 political prisoners, which they agreed to do. He did ask them to help the process of human rights for the future by adopting a much more cooperative attitude towards the International Red Cross, which Raul Castro agreed to do. And he basically, through his secret emissaries, told the Cubans, we are going to open up this process. I'm going to do what a president can do through directives to punch holes in the embargo, to punch holes in the ban on free travel to Cuba, to allow commerce to start to flow, to press the telecom companies like Google and others to go ahead and operate in Cuba. And you are going to be the recipient of this for better or for worse. It certainly is going to have an impact economically and socially on your society. And of course, in our minds, we would predict that eventually it'll have a political impact as well. But for our interests, this is the right thing to do. We will cease our efforts at regime change, but we are going to have normal relations, and obviously that is going to have that's going to portend a different future for not only U.S.-Cuban relations, but for Cuba as a country. The spies came back. There was jubilation. They have returned. There's the pictures of the two presidents simultaneously on television. This is the Communist Party newspaper the very next day. In the middle of the secret talks, you know, Barack Obama and Raul Castro met at the memorial service for Nelson Mandela. Everybody thought it was a chance meeting, but now that we know that these secret talks were going on, I'm fairly certain that it was a planned idea. For a long time, there was a discussion of what they actually said to one another. You could see them mouth a few words on the television camera, and then we did find out what was said. Raul Castro said to President Obama, "I am Castro." And President Obama said, "I know." And then the president, our president, went up and gave this speech in the spirit of Nelson Mandela, in which he talked about reconciliation between groups and parties and countries that have very distinct and diverse interests. And of course, you could just hear in the background, those of us who wanted to hear this, a discussion about the United States and Cuba, and the spirit of Nelson Mandela kind of hanging over it. And that is what I think is driving now and overshadowing, and in a positive way, the process that you are watching as U.S.-Cuban talks go forward. And I'm just going to leave you with this thought. You know that you are going to be coming out of this meeting, and you're going to be watching not only a whole dynamic about Iran, a whole dynamic about the Middle East, but talks between the United States and Cuba that are much more overt than these clandestine talks that have gone on in the past. And the two countries are discussing what needs to be done to arrive at that point when first they can have normal diplomatic relations. They can have ambassadors for the first time in both countries, and that the interest sections will now be officially called embassies. There is a possibility that Secretary of State Kerry will go to Havana and inaugurate the new embassy there. The plan is to change some of the real outstanding problems in U.S.-Cuban relations before President Obama in 5 weeks goes to Panama and attends the Summit of the Americas, where, for the first time, along with all the other Latin American presidents, the Cubans will have been invited and Raul Castro will be attending as well. This will be the first time since 1959, the Cuban Revolution, in which a president of Cuba and a president of the United States have sat in the same room together. I'm going to predict two things to you. One is they will both get a huge round of applause, and both a literal and symbolic bear hug from the entire rest of the Latin American community, all of whom will offer their support for keeping the momentum going for more positive political, economic, and social, cultural relations. And I predict that just like Che Guevara brought a box of cigars for John Kennedy, Raul Castro will arrive at the Summit of the Americas with a beautiful box of Cohiba Lanceros for Barack Obama, also known to smoke cigarettes and cigars, and that they will kind of go off together into the side rooms or the grounds of the the state that this meeting is being held in and smoke a Cuban cigar together, kind of a peace pipe, if you will. Then the press will get the news that this has happened, and the world will, of course, wait to hear what the next positive step in U.S.-Cuban relations will be.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst at the National Security Archive in Washington and director of the Archive's Cuba and Chile documentation projects. He is co-author of the forthcoming book, Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. You can listen to this program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. There you can find this and many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast from our website or on iTunes. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.